Donate now and help keep nonprofit community radio alive. Thank you.
Support comes from UCLA Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Ethiocolor on Friday, September 29th at 8 p.m. at UCLA's Nimoy Theater. Led by Melaku Belay, Ethiocolor creates energetic performances that blend contemporary influences with the traditional instruments and the shoulder-shimming dances of Ethiopia's Asmari culture. For more information, visit cap.ucla.edu or kpfk.org.
Yo, this is your brother Speech from the crew Arrested Development. You rocking with KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles.
Welcome to another episode of Gray Zone Radio. This week, Aaron Mate returns with Max Blumenthal. And they talk about the financial sabotage by GoFundMe of Gray Zone's recent fundraiser. And they also cover Blinken's disturbing trip to Ukraine. To catch the rest of the live stream, visit the Gray Zone's YouTube channel and visit thegrayzone.com. That's the GRAYzone.com to catch up on the latest news. Now let's take a listen.
Max Blumenthal. I'm here with award-winning Canadian journalist Aaron Mate, who's back from a little hiatus. Welcome back, Aaron. Everyone's been asking after you.
I heard some fun stuff happen while I was gone, including you guys having a crazy fight with GoFundMe, and I was wondering what the latest is on that. You put up a fundraiser. It was very successful. Last time I checked, there was like over $90,000 on GoFundMe. And then all of a sudden, GoFundMe wouldn't let you transfer the money. They told you there were some external concerns. You went over to Spot Fund, where the fundraiser is still going on. I understand. What's the latest with that?
We won. I mean, we defunded GoFundMe. So they take a cut. They're a company. They're not some, I mean, they pose as a nonprofit, but they're a for-profit company. And they not only take a cut of whatever they raise off your back, but they also ask for tips, so that they can help other good causes. And lots of people gave tips and they had to give all of that back. And it seems that everyone understood the stakes here and that we had to teach GoFundMe a lesson. So they also bombarded them with indignant letters and then supported us over at Spot Fund. And we've outraised substantially what we raised at GoFundMe, which means Kit Clarenberg, Aaron, Alex Rubenstein, and Wyatt Reed will be a part of our organization for a long-term period. I mean, that's still not a lot of money that we're close to 140 now. That's still not a lot for three journalists in this economy, but that's what we're a shoestring organization. They're independent journalists. We'll try to raise more, but that's going to support them. So I feel really encouraged about what happened here. And we've been supported by our friends in independent media. Glenn Greenwald had me on. Jimmy Dore had me on. I'm going to be on Russell Brand on Monday. And this has forced a moment of accountability for GoFundMe. Matt Taibbi also and Katie Halper had me on. And Matt actually reached out to GoFundMe and said, "What the hell are you doing?" And they said, "Well, what we did is perfectly normal, and that the Gray Zone voluntarily ended this fundraiser." That's also what they told Al Jazeera. So they're even getting scrutinized by mainstream media. And that is the most cynical lie. They almost never freeze or pause fundraisers due to some external concerns. And there are often external concerns. I mean, they raised money for the millions for the cop who beat or shot to death a teenager in France, sparking riots across the country. They've raised money for all sorts of Israeli causes. So there's no reason to accept that. And yeah, we voluntarily ended it because we had to make sure everyone got their money refunded. I mean, that's the bottom line. And because of all of the PR damage they were suffering, they actually sent someone, still sort of a faceless person with just a first name, to sort of offer us a kind of olive branch on their trust and safety vetting process. So they're basically willing to cry uncle after we rain down fire and fury upon them, but they wouldn't have done it otherwise. And they, you know, they kept me on the line for weeks without refusing to transfer donations and not telling any of our supporters that they had been, their donations hadn't reached us and that they were being held up by some faceless entity. And Aaron, I mean, I said in all my interviews, I think the same people who tried to have you kicked off Twitter are behind this.
Well, I think that's a fair bet. Who knows? But I think it's a fair bet. I do got to say, this is the first time I've known you for a long time. This is the first time I can remember you doing anything that I would classify as naive. Like you did this on GoFundMe, despite knowing, you know, you were familiar with what, who GoFundMe is and their record before of succumbing to pressure campaigns like this. But I think, I don't know, it looks to me like you naively thought that they wouldn't cave to the inevitable pressure campaign that we always get in situations like this. And I've lost track now of how many times we've had to like take a pause from doing the journalism we do to now then defend ourselves from these kinds of insane attacks. But it seems like, I don't know what the average is now, but there's,
it's
so
like
many
every other week, year.
every other week. Like,
yeah, I'd almost forgot where we were, you know, stuck, kind of like stranded in Lisbon, Portugal, yeah, defending ourselves against like the Zelensky regime because he was canceling our talk at Web Summit. We didn't even know why we'd been invited. And I mean,
yeah. And then when Kit Clarenberg got detained in the UK,
yeah,
and it's still, and that case is still open, right?
The investigation into Kit is still open. I mean, yeah. I don't know why he would go back there. By the way, I just was across town. That's why I was a little late interviewing Craig Murray, former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, who's become a real dissident in the UK, a supporter of the Scottish independence movement, but also one of the leading supporters of Julian Assange. And his blog is just an essential look at British intelligence intrigues and covert operations and propaganda. He just rips them to shreds every day. He's a real gadfly. So they threw him in jail. You remember that. He was jailed for supposedly identifying a witness or an accuser of Alex Salmond, who is the head of the Scottish National Party. And the case was just so shabby and so ridiculous. He was obviously thrown in jail because he was upsetting the British national security state. And everyone's feeling it. But there's a sense that, I mean, my sense is I didn't like sign up to be some dissident or something. This is the kind of journalism I always wanted to do. And I don't think the national security state wants us to be seen in the same light as Julian Assange. They've had to actually just come in and slam the jackboot in his face. What they want to do is keep quietly silencing us, suppressing us. I mean, look at the numbers on our YouTube videos. They're like, we have almost 300,000 subscribers and they're like 4,000 views. We're so obviously suppressed there. And they want to keep trying to get us removed from platforms. But they will act, especially in the UK, with the jackboot instead of the quiet shadow ban, as we saw with Kit. And we'll keep reporting on it. I mean, if we become the story, then so be it. I think that's part of our role as journalists and as advocates is to expose the system any way we can. And if that means just through our sheer existence and what happens to us, then that's important to do.
Amen. Amen.
Yeah. So where have you been?
I've been trying to finish my book about the Ukraine proxy war. And I'm learning every day that a book is a really challenging thing to do. So I'm still not done, but I'm really close, and I don't know when it will be out, but when I'm done, it will be out as soon as possible. And I appreciate the patience of people who, you know, support the Gray Zone. What can I say? A book, writing a book. Yeah, it's a lot.
What you can say is, you know, tell us about the book. And is there a separate book about Russiagate, or how are you doing?
Yeah. So the book was, so my initial plan was for a book, like the book I was writing was how Russiagate led into the Ukraine proxy war. But at a certain point, I just realized this book is way too big and it's way too ambitious. This is like a magnum opus if I do it that way. So now I'm going to do actually three books. The first book is about the Ukraine proxy war. Second book is about Russiagate. The third book is about the Syria dirty war, particularly all the allegations of chemical weapons and the cover up of evidence undermining those allegations at the OPCW. That will be the third book in this Russia mania trilogy, basically. So that's the new plan. So the first book will be the Ukraine proxy war.
Well, that's incredible. I mean, if you can pull off the trilogy, I think that'll be an indispensable resource for people trying to understand. It's really about us. It's not about, I mean, it is about Ukraine, but it's really about what's happened to our politics. And, you know, to bring in the analysis of Russiagate as the background noise for the Ukraine proxy war is so essential. And anyone who didn't see with the dawn of Russiagate that we were going to go to war with Russia in the most cowardly way possible, using somebody else's army to fight and die because the political price would be too high if Americans were dying for these soft-handed neocons. If you didn't see that, then you were blind. And that's what you've been saying since 2016, 2017.
And you as well, of course. And the Syria tie here is that Syria is a similar playbook. Using, you know, non-U.S. boots on the ground, having a proxy war abroad, trying to undermine a deterrent to U.S. hegemony, which is Syria, because of their support for Hezbollah and Hamas, and just generally being outside of U.S. control, which has been a annoyance of the U.S. national security state for a very long time. So the Syria dirty war was the chance to finally, you know, take out this independent, you know, Arab nation that supports resistance movements. And the Russia tie-in comes when Russia comes in and actually help save the Syrian government from collapse. And that really angers neocons in Washington, whose animus to Russia only grows and helps fuel this whole Cold War climate. I mean, you talk about some of this in your book, The Management of Savagery. And what I'm going to try to do when I talk about Syria and the third book is just especially the role of chemical weapons allegations in all this. Because to justify dirty wars, to justify sanctions that deny people, you know, the basics they need to live, you have to paint this cartoonish picture of your enemy, in this case, Syria. And in this case, the tool they picked was these chemical weapons allegations, which, as we've covered many times, in all the major cases where there's been serious investigations, all those are shown to be either false flags where the rebels carry them out, as was the case in Ghouta 2013, or faked, as was the case in Douma in 2018. And that's what that book of mine will focus on whenever I get to it after the first two.
Yeah. I mean, if you understand the Syria proxy war and what happened there, you'll easily understand what's happening in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And what we saw in Syria was atrocity fabrication on a grand scale, and the construction of this vast media apparatus on the ground that was completely unaccountable to the Western media, but which fed the Western media atrocity exhibition in order to cultivate public support in the West for regime change, arming the Al-Qaeda-linked rebels. And that media apparatus was linked to Al-Qaeda as well, arming jihadist bandits to rampage across the country, sanctioning the entire country. And possibly even direct intervention, which is what, you know, McCain was pushing for. So there's actually a book out called Atrocity Fabrication and Its Consequences by A.B. Abrams on Clarity Press. I blurbed it, and it's a really great study. But I think when you zoom in on Syria like you're going to do, you can understand just how cynical the whole thing was. And they're repeating, they're borrowing parts of that playbook for Ukraine as well, obviously. But I think they're a little bit less aggressive about it because of the fear of direct a lot of Western countries are afraid of direct NATO intervention.
Yeah. And the playbook too of also siding with the most extremist elements of a country to achieve your goals. Like, so in the case of Syria, we're told we were arming moderate rebels. Joe Biden later blurted out the truth. And when he was speaking at Harvard in 2014, October 2014 when he said there was no moderate middle in Syria. Our allies were arming Al-Qaeda with you know, tens of millions of dollars and tens of thousands of weapons. And Biden had to apologize for that because he blurted out the truth. But the only thing he got wrong was that the U.S. – it wasn't U.S. allies doing that. It was U.S. allies doing that basically on behalf of the U.S. The U.S. was at the center of all of this. And that's the only thing that Biden left out. But he still had to apologize because he admitted that the insurgency was dominated by Al-Qaeda. And so this playbook of, you know, in the name of defending democracy, fighting authoritarianism, finding the most extreme elements within a country. In the case of Syria, actually, not even fully inside the country, because so many of the people who were in the jihadi forces came from outside the country. But just finding extremist elements to support, to destroy a country and achieve your own aims. And that's also what happened in Ukraine, where the U.S. sided with the most extreme elements of society, the nationalists, the Bandera movement. That was the driving force behind the Maidan coup, not behind the Maidan protests when they began. That was, you know, tens of thousands of people, you know, many of them ordinary citizens just protesting corruption and wanting to be closer to the EU. But the people who, the muscle that carried out the coup, as these far-right nationalists bragged about, was, you know, neo-Nazi far-right elements. And that's who then dominated the post-coup government. And that's who then oversaw the ensuing civil war. And that's who the U.S. has been siding with every single time, including when Zelensky was elected on a mandate of peace. And the far-right nationalists of Ukraine, you know, threatened him. Essentially, the U.S. took their side rather than Zelensky's side, too. So that's the playbook from Ukraine to Syria.
Sergei Bondar of C-14, a neo-Nazi group, boasted at the Bandera Day event in 2021 that without us, the nationalist forces, Maidan would have been a gay pride parade.
That's right.
And he's, and, I mean, they were young people who wanted kind of like a pro-European technocracy. And they thought, you know, if they were part of the, they thought they're going to be part of the EU and that they wouldn't be the sick, poor man of Europe anymore. And they didn't want corrupt leaders. And I can understand why they went out there. And then the freedom cookies came. The rest is history.
Yeah. And then, by the way, with polls still showed the country was deeply divided. So, you know, half the country didn't support the Maidan, even the peaceful aspects of the Maidan protest didn't even support it. It was a very divided country. And that's why the answer in Ukraine was always to respect its divisions and not try to pull it into one camp, whether it's the Russian camp or the Western camp. But the U.S. policy was predicated on forcing it to make that choice. That's what Bill Burns warned about in his famous cable, Nyet means Nyet, relaying the concerns of Russians that if you force Ukraine into the NATO camp, that's going to create a civil war and Russia will be forced to intervene because then millions of formerly Soviet citizens who still identify with Russia, who have family in Russia, will be on one side and will be, you know, obligated to protect them. That was Bill Burns warning that in 2008. And that's pretty much exactly what happened. So he foretold a lot.
Yeah. And just not to belabor the point too much, but go back to 2010 and look at the regions that voted for Yanukovych.
Yeah.
Versus the regions that voted for Yulia Tymoshenko, who was sort of the Western Ukraine, the Western Ukraine pro-Western figure. It's almost the same as the, it's identical to the support for the Maidan coup. And the country was completely divided. And you can also look at that map to understand that map of electoral results to understand the civil war that soon ensued. Those regions that were heaviest in support of Yanukovych attempted to secede. And that set the stage for the proxy war, the Russian intervention or invasion, and what we're facing now. And so many stupid propagandists will instead display a map of the Ukrainian referendum in support of ending the Soviet Union and completely paper over 2010 in order to paper over the ethnic and national divide in Ukraine. And I mean, that's what it all comes down to. So when do you know what the publication schedule is for your book?
No, I just got to finish it. You know how it is to finish a book. It never ends. There's always, you know, but the Ukraine book is close to being finished. I don't know if we can get it out this year, but certainly early next year is a fair bet. And, you know, I just want to make one point about the issue of regions in Ukraine. Someone could correct me if I'm wrong. They can look it up if they want to. I'm pretty sure the only region of Ukraine that didn't vote, that did not vote in the majority for Zelensky, was Western Ukraine, which is the Bandera heartland, heartland, the nationalist heartland, right? And why would they be the only region in Ukraine not to vote in the majority for Zelensky? Because he was talking about making peace. He was talking about, and I'm not saying he was sincere, but he was talking about making peace, ending the Donbass war. And so accordingly,
everybody forgets about that period. Yeah, it's such a key period. And you know, he's running against Viktor Medvedchuk, who is, you know, from the Party of Regions. He's portrayed somewhat falsely as a Russian stooge. But he only got like 15-20% because so much of the Russian speaking population thought if we could just get a consensus candidate like Zelensky, we could finally get this done and end this nightmare. And the U.S. and some of the kind of Soros Open Society backed NGOs in Kiev were initially kind of critical or hostile to Zelensky until he began to turn. And the turn came when he started banning Medvedchuk's TV stations, his broadcasting outlets, just banning opposition media. The U.S. told him to ban them. The State Department openly supported it. He did it. And, you know, giving up on Minsk, caving to the neo-Nazis on the withdrawal from the so-called gray zone in the Donbass. But there was a point when Zelensky, when it was, I mean, I remember talking to a legislator from Crimea who I met when I visited Damascus, and I met him. He was Russian, and he said, everybody in Crimea is pulling for Zelensky. He's our last hope. Yep. We really are hoping Zelensky succeeds. And it's just so crazy to think back on that.
I mean, there's a clip I've shared before of when I interviewed Stephen F. Cohen for the Gray Zone, when him and I met up in Manhattan in October 2019. And this was as the impeachment of Trump was getting underway, because Trump froze some weapons to Ukraine while him and Giuliani were pressuring Ukraine to announce some investigations into the origins of Russiagate and the Bidens. And, you know, everyone was on board with this, and like left liberals, progressives were on board because finally Trump was going to be held accountable. They were so excited. And Stephen F. Cohen warned that this is like the last chance to make peace in Ukraine, and that Zelensky needs the U.S.'s back. Rather than trying to impeach a president for pausing some weapons to Ukraine, you should be putting all your energy towards supporting Zelensky and protecting him from the far right nationalists who are threatening his life, literally, if he makes good on his promise to implement peace. And of course, everybody here ignored that, with the exception of us and a few others, you know, in terms of the media, and the rest is history. You know, that, and then Adam Schiff got up and said, we aid Ukraine so that we can fight Russia over there, and we don't have to fight Russia here. And progressives either applauded that or didn't think of the implications of celebrating the fact that we're using Ukraine to fight Russia. And 2 years later, the logical end game happened. Russia invaded Ukraine to end the fight, largely as a result of liberals in the U.S. being enlisted in a neocon proxy war and cheering it on rather than trying to stop it. And, you know, I just want to read a quote to you I found. I hadn't seen it before, so I wanted to share it with you because I find it's funny and it's so revealing. It's from Ben Rhodes' book. Ben Rhodes is a former top aide to Barack Obama. Before joining Obama, he was a screenwriter, or an aspiring screenwriter, I think. And anyway, then he went on to become like a senior national security aide to Obama, which says something about the Obama administration. But anyway, he's talking in Ben Rhodes' book, he's talking about the Maidan coup, which we were discussing before, Max and I. And this is what Ben Rhodes writes about Putin and his reaction to it. Ben Rhodes says, Putin believed that, quote, and I'm quoting Ben Rhodes, Putin believed that, quote, the protests that overthrew Yanukovych were initiated by the U.S. because some of its leaders received grants from U.S. democracy promotion programs. So Ben Rhodes is admitting that some of the leaders of the coup that overthrew Yanukovych received grants from U.S. democracy promotion programs, which is hilarious. Like, that's who our democracy promotion grants go to, is coup leaders. But second of all, he can't understand why Putin could possibly see that the U.S. was involved when all that happened was we funded some of the people who launched a coup against Yanukovych. And Rhodes is like, you know, mocking Putin for believing that.
Yeah. And then on the next page, and then Putin sent Facebook ads against us and destroyed our democracy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's exactly what he does. He calls that an unprecedented attack on our democracy and blah, blah, blah. And he also acknowledges the Victoria Nuland phone call where Nuland was caught picking who would the next prime minister of Ukraine would be, Yatsenyuk, right? And he acknowledges that. And he says that on the call, it sounded like Nuland was picking who the next leader of Ukraine would be. He doesn't have any criticism of that. He doesn't even say anything more about that. But then he says, because Russia, or I mean, we think it's Russia, let's assume Russia did it, because Russia was the one that intercepted that call and leaked it, that Russia had crossed the Rubicon. So we don't cross the Rubicon by interfering in Ukraine to the point where we're picking their next leaders before we back a coup. Russia crossed the Rubicon by intercepting our plans for that and releasing it to the public. That's Ben Rhodes' claim in his book.
Imagine if the U.S. got a cable of signals intelligence cable on Russia picking the next leader of Canada. I mean, it would be like Pearl Harbor. They would portray it as Pearl Harbor, but worse. Yeah. We would finally invade Canada. I mean, the invasion should start now, but we would finally do it. I'd hope to talk about the ADL. We'll get to that. It's the first time they're facing this level of elite accountability or pressure. So I think it's an important moment, and it's important to understand what it signifies. But since we're talking about Ukraine, we could go right into Blinken's trip if you want.
All right. Well, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, one of the most devoted war hawks in the Biden administration, firmly opposed to any diplomacy with Russia, to the point where when the nation's top military officer, General Mark Milley, the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, when he called for diplomacy, Blinken, supposedly the nation's top diplomat, was firmly against him. And, you know, Milley was basically told to quiet down, and he has since. So Blinken won that round. So now Blinken is visiting Ukraine to, I guess, like witness the fruits of his labors by prolonging the proxy war as long as possible and announcing another $1 billion in weapons and basically also announcing that the U.S. is going to do in Ukraine what it won't do at home, with some exceptions occasionally, which is invest in Ukraine's infrastructure. So here is the Secretary of State.
For Ukraine not only to survive, but to thrive, we're also supporting its efforts to build from Russia's aggression. At the Ukraine Recovery Conference held in London a few months ago, I pledged that the United States would invest more than $520 million in making Ukraine's energy infrastructure, more than half of which has been destroyed by Russia, cleaner, more resilient, and more integrated with Europe. We're making new investments to enhance the transparency of Ukraine's institutions and to bolster the rule of law so that Ukraine's democracy is even more responsive to the needs of its people and can attract the private capital needed to rebuild. We're engaged in assisting the government of Ukraine on anti-corruption efforts and on efforts to ensure accountability and full transparency of all the assistance we're providing, as well as the security of U.S.-provided defense articles and technologies.
So that's Tony Blinken assuring us that the U.S. is helping Ukraine root out corruption. This is one of the most, if not the most, corrupt country in Europe, maybe in the world. I don't know.
I mean, just to qualify or to clarify, I mean, Zelensky has fired Alexei Reznikov, the defense minister. He's fired several officials in charge of the draft, which is essentially forced conscription because they're taking bribes because so many men are desperate to get out of the draft and not die and be cannon fodder for Tony Blinken. So Zelensky is being pushed clearly by the U.S. to make these moves. And I think that's part of why Blinken was there. Don't you think that's because they want Zelensky to be able to be seen as a valid recipient for billions more as the war proceeds indefinitely? And so Zelensky can be sort of reelected with a not so quiet nudge from the U.S. or support from the U.S.?
Oh, absolutely. And Seymour Hersh reported this, that when William Burns went over to meet Zelensky, whenever that was, that Burns came over with a request that, like, okay, we know you're skimming a lot off the top. Fine. That's, you know, that's par for the course, but just, can you take less money? Can you maybe skim off less money? Cause this is getting out of hand. And he gave him a list of a bunch of officials who were just being way too outlandish with their corruption, like driving around in fancy cars and, you know, buying villas. And he asked that they be fired, and they were. So basically,
oh, and whenever Kolomoisky also, he's putting Kolomoisky on trial. That was the right guy who basically funded his entire career.
Yeah, I wonder about that. Why is Zelensky now going after the oligarch who backed him to begin with in the first place? I wonder what that's about. It's interesting. And Kolomoisky also was a big funder of the Azov Battalion.
He was. I mean, the Panama Papers show that he had created these offshore accounts to basically sponsor Servant of the People, the production of the Zelensky show, which was the basis for his presidential campaign. So this is a major intrigue. I mean, U.S. media has covered it, but they're not talking to Ukrainian insiders. They don't seem very curious about it. They seem a little about as curious about it as they are about Hunter Biden and the firing of the Ukrainian prosecutor, Viktor Shokin. So, but this is all U.S. pressure. It's obviously U.S. pressure to legitimize Zelensky. So that's what I think the first purpose of Blinken's trip is. But the second purpose is to rustle up more contracts for the arms industry, keep the war going. I mean, Aaron, you reported earlier this year you wrote on Blinken's anti-diplomacy tour, where he basically spoke out forcefully against a ceasefire.
Oh, he gave the most insane speech. I believe that was it was somewhere in Europe, where basically there would be no negotiations at all with Russia, and Ukraine was going to be this permanently militarized, constantly at war country on Russia's border. And we're going to build up Ukraine for the future, all while meanwhile, Ukraine's being decimated right now. But Blinken is so unconcerned with Ukrainians that he was already fantasizing about a future when, you know, Ukraine can be this like even more militarized U.S. proxy to challenge Russia. Then he wasn't even thinking about the present, and to the point where he went on a global tour to literally procure arms for Ukraine to try to pressure global South countries, because there's been a problem that's been exposed in the last year, maybe more, where the U.S. and its allies actually don't have enough weapons for Ukraine. They don't have the production capacity that Russia does. And so they've been having to go around to other countries that aren't their traditional allies to basically beg for weapons all across the global South. And Blinken went on that tour pleading for weapons, but he got rebuffed. But that's Blinken's job. He's not a diplomat. He's an arms merchant. And there was actually a really interesting line recently in the Washington Post from David Ignatius, who's a veteran columnist, very close with U.S. intelligence and the Biden administration, you know, basically speaks for them. And one thing he noted was that, you know, Ukraine's been begging for these long-range attack-em missiles, attack-ems,
yeah,
right? But he said the reason the U.S. isn't giving Ukraine attack-ems, it's not anymore the reason we got before, which is that Biden's concerned about an escalation with Russia. The reason is the Pentagon says we can't give up our attack-ems because we might need those for a conflict with China. So that's right. So that's like a reminder that Ukraine does not come first for these people. Hegemony comes first. And right now, a key target of U.S. hegemony is China. And the U.S. is preparing for the possibility of war with China. So therefore, even though we're claiming that Ukraine's in this existential battle for its freedom, that they're the front line of democracy, if Putin doesn't win there, he'll go on to Poland or wherever else they can fantasize about Putin trying to, you know, conquer in Europe. Even though we're claiming all that with this lofty rhetoric, when Ukraine asks for something that it says it needs, we can't give them that because hegemony comes first and we might need to fight China. So sorry, Ukraine. So on the one hand, it's like it's welcome, I guess, that the U.S. isn't giving a weapon that will escalate the war in Ukraine. But when you look at the reason, it's because they need it for an escalation, a possible escalation somewhere else against China.
And we have to teach the Russians a lesson in Ukraine, or China will invade Taiwan. That's what we're constantly told by neocons. I don't know if Blinken himself has used that line, but here's a photo that I think is so revealing of what this whole trip, the cynicism of this trip, how disturbing it is. It's Tony Blinken in a gigantic cemetery, Ukrainian military cemetery, with Dmytro Kuleba, the Ukrainian foreign minister, his counterpart. I mean, look at this. This is like him presiding over his works.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, as you said, he obstructed diplomacy in order to ensure this much death. And how much death is it? I mean, we hear so many estimates. The Pentagon has put out its own estimate of 150,000 Ukrainian casualties, killed or injured, put out of action by injuries. That's obviously going to be the most conservative estimate since the Pentagon wants to continue sending weapons. But think about that. What percentage of society that is? What is it? Ukraine have 80 million people? The Wall Street Journal has reported 50,000 Ukrainians who have lost at least one limb in this war. That's staggering. That's about the same number of Germans who lost one or more limbs during World War II. And so what was the German casualty count? I think it was like 500,000. It was enormous. I mean, they lost their entire U-boat fleet. Like most of their Navy was wasted. So why are we to believe that the number of Ukrainians killed or injured wouldn't be 500,000?
Yeah.
Considering that they're not exactly getting the best medevac service, you know, during the golden hour, the hour when you can be saved when you're wounded in combat, you need to be immediately evacuated, usually by helicopter. And that's not really happening at the front in the eastern, you know, at the front in the Donbass. So the number, I think, is much higher than 150,000. And that's blood on Tony Blinken's soft little guitar-plucking West exec advisor's hands. It's a sickening display, and you have to be completely ignorant of the context to actually take Tony Blinken seriously in this photo, although Kuleba does.
Well, it's easy for people to not get the context because, for example, if you're a consumer of establishment U.S. media, even many dissident media outlets, you would not know, I think, arguably the most important fact, unless I'm forgetting something, of the Ukraine war so far, of the post-Russia invasion period of the Ukraine war, because the war has been going on since 2014, but the post-Russian invasion period, since February 2022, you would not know that the U.S. and the U.K. blocked a peace deal that was reached in early April 2022. So just weeks into the war, multiple sources from Ukraine, from NATO allies, from Israel, the former Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, from Fiona Hill, former U.S. official, have all confirmed that there was a peace deal reached. The basic premise was Ukraine would remain neutral. The issue of Crimea would be basically frozen, and Russia would withdraw to its pre-February 2022 lines. That was the basic bargain. And yet no major U.S. media outlet has reported this fact. You cannot even acknowledge that a deal was reached, except for in Foreign Affairs. That's the only exception. Foreign Affairs, in this article by Fiona Hill and Angela Stint, reported that U.S. officials had confirmed to them that there was a peace deal. Now, they didn't say what happened to it because I think they didn't want to acknowledge what other people have reported, which is that the U.S. and the U.K. blocked it, as relayed by Boris Johnson when he went over to Zelensky and said, we're not going to back you up if you make a deal with Russia. Russia has to be fought. So if you're a consumer of U.S. media, unless you happen to catch that in Foreign Affairs, which is like an elite journal, you would not know that the U.S. blocked a peace deal that could have stopped this war from getting so much worse. And, you know, to illustrate, there's a recent article in The New Yorker by Keith Gessen. It's about, like, is it time to maybe to like negotiate with Russia? And the main person he interviews is this guy, Samuel Cherup of RAND Corporation, who advocates negotiations. But even Samuel Cherup and Keith Gessen, who, you know, support diplomacy, even they can't acknowledge that there was a peace deal reached in Turkey that was blocked. They allude to it. So Keith Gessen alludes to it. He mentions that there was talks and they collapsed, but he doesn't actually give what actually happened, which is that there was a tentative deal and it was blocked by the West. But he does, the one positive thing he does is he does speak to a former Ukrainian official who basically admits that that was Ukraine's best chance at peace. And so let me quote this. This is from Keith Gessen. The former Ukrainian official believes that the Istanbul talks were the best chance at a more or less stable peace. Quote, back then, Bakhmut was a beautiful city. Mariupol was under Ukrainian control. But now there is no win-win solution any longer. Someone will have to lose. He hoped it would be Russia, but he feared it would be Ukraine. And I asked him, this is Keith Gessen, I asked him when public opinion might begin to turn, quote, when every single person knows someone who has been killed or wounded, he replied. And this is now Keith Gessen. The country was getting there. So this is a former Ukrainian official admitting that Ukraine's best chance for peace was in Istanbul at those talks. What Keith Gessen doesn't tell us is what happened to those talks, which is that the U.S. blocked them. And right now we're seeing the ongoing result.
Again and again, again and again. And what the U.S. condemned countries that are suffering from grain shortage because of the war in the developing world attack their calls for a ceasefire at the UN. I mean, that's what his role was. And just one quick point on this idea of negotiations. Now you're seeing all sorts of voices calling for negotiations. It's in the New Yorker, it's in the Nation magazine, which, you know, has wavered. It's all over. I think it's too late. The U.S. The U.S. shafted itself diplomatically because its position and the position of the Ukrainians at the negotiating table was much stronger back then, and it may have been much stronger last fall than it is now that their counteroffensive has been this complete catastrophic flop. That's why they don't tell us about what a failure it is in U.S. media, except in bits and pieces, because they don't want the public to realize. Russia, why would Russia negotiate now? And who do they have to negotiate with? The people who sabotaged every negotiation again and again and again? No, if they have the upper hand on the battlefield, and Ukraine's military is increasingly a collection of boys and older men who are being kidnapped off the streets of cities and taken in vans to the front, along with people with very little training, they could go on an offensive themselves. Kadyrov, the leader of the Chechenian leader, has explicitly said there is no reason why Putin should negotiate. He should just attack. And much of the Russian public believes that as well, that they should just go in hard instead of going in with this special military operation to try to get the West's attention and force everyone to the negotiating table with this Clausewitzian strategy. So I think we're not going to see negotiate. This is going to be settled the same way Syria was, with brute force. And that is a massive tragedy. And Tony Blinken is laughing it up. He's laughing it up with his counterpart, Kuleba, at McDonald's. They're at McDonald's.
Right now, we didn't order in the kitchen.
No, I'm a jerk. You know,
I cannot eat you this because of my doctor advice, but
I have the same.
But I cannot.
Look at this. I think forced exchange
is something that she will forgive me with you
at once, at least.
Yeah. Okay.
Look at Blinken's cold, dead eyes trying to force a personality.
Where I used to live in Washington, we had a McDonald's around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
Very good breakfast sandwich. Very
good. Where I used to live in Washington, we had a McDonald's right around the
corner. Yeah, right. Yeah, right. He had the breakfast sandwich at McDonald's. Yeah, right. Like, everything he says is just oozes phoniness. There's nothing real about this guy. Everything is fake. Everything. Everything.
When I was a student, my best hamburger food was actually to go to McDonald's.
Well done. I'm sure that was a rare, very rare.
Very, very rare.
My best hangover food was McDonald's in the morning. I'm sure that was very rare.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, they're there to hype up McDonald's to get corporate investment in Ukraine, because that's another aspect of this war, is the Americanization of Ukraine, the corporatization of Ukraine. And so and McDonald's has also been forced to exit Moscow, where they're replaced by some McDonald's-like restaurant, and everything basically tastes the same, because, like, it's not that hard to do. Maybe they don't have the special sauce. But it's also that McDonald's, they're basically embodying the Thomas Friedman theory that countries that have McDonald's don't go to war with each other.
And also that I think the bet was in, like, the belief in Washington, I think they actually believe this, that, like, if we cut off Russia from the West, that will help accelerate this process where the Russian people turn on Putin. They really, really believe that. Well, what is the result? There was recently an article in Foreign Affairs called Putin's Age of Chaos. And this is by a writer with, like, a you know, like the Carnegie Russian Center or something like that, some like Western aligned think tank in Russia. And what she reports is basically, I'll read some of it actually, because it's really interesting. She basically writes that according to polls, by every important metric, support for the government has grown since the war. This is a quote. Polls show that since the war began, the percentage of Russians who overtly admire Putin has grown from 8% to 19%, and 68% of Russians now say they want him to be reelected, a significant jump from 48% of Russians before the Russian invasion. The war has also increased support for all official institutions, the cabinet, regional governors, parliament, and even the ruling party, United Russia. And she goes on to say why she thinks this is. And the reason is, she says, that, quote, Russians hunger for geopolitical security. And they see Putin as, quote, offering protection from the hostile West. And because of this, the Russian people, again, quoting her, have delegated to Putin the right to deal with the West, which many Russians believe threaten their country's very existence, even if that causes domestic turmoil owing to stringent sanctions and crackdowns on liberals. So the very thing that Western liberals, Western neocons thought would turn the Russian population against Putin, which is like Western sanctions and a growing Western role in the proxy war to make Russia bleed, has actually increased support for Putin at home. So even by that very narrow metric of like whether or not the U.S. aim in Russia has worked, it's been a it's backfired, as these things always do. And by the way, on the issue of diplomacy, Jens Stoltenberg of NATO, he just bragged just a few days ago, if not yesterday, he bragged that before the war, Russia gave this draft treaty that basically called for Ukraine to be neutral for NATO not to dissolve, but just to roll back its military infrastructure post-1997. Because after 1997, that's when Clinton began overseeing this huge expansion of NATO. So Russia was asking that the military infrastructure built up in those post-1997 NATO states, not all NATO states, just the post-1997 NATO states, that be rolled back. And Jens Stoltenberg bragged about how, of course, we said no. Of course, we said no to that. And he goes on to say, like, that's why, you know, Russia just wanted to stop NATO enlargement. That's what he says was Russia's goal here. So he admitted and he bragged about rejecting Russian efforts to find a diplomatic solution that way. And then what's the result on top of destroying Ukraine? Then when it comes down to a NATO summit where Ukraine's been promised forever, we're going to, you know, make you a member one day. NATO rebuffed Ukraine just a few months ago and wouldn't even tell them what conditions they need to join. So basically, NATO rebuffed Russia's request to declare Ukraine would never join NATO just for the sake of being able to tell Ukraine, yeah, you're actually not going to join NATO anyway. Was this really worth a war? I mean, that's a question that should be asked, but of course it's not.
Well, I think there was a significant exchange between our friend Claire Daly and Jens Stoltenberg that might be illustrative of the kind of absurd rhetoric we've been hearing from NATO. It's a rare moment of accountability for Stoltenberg, so I think it's worth watching.
Mr. Stoltenberg, you asked us to look at where we are today compared to when the invasion started. I'm not really sure what you meant by we. I know you spent a lot of time on NATO, maybe that's the we, about the expansion with Sweden and Finland, but you were considerably quieter about the bitter disappointment experienced by Ukraine in Vilnius, that the hopes that they thought of a path into NATO didn't actually work out according to plan. Our chair said that aid somewhat compensated, which others have kind of said is that Zelensky's silence was basically purchased. But in essence, really, haven't you let Ukraine down in terms of the pathway to membership? And on the subject of Ukraine, is it not the case that your rhetoric and reality are going in opposite directions and the world is beginning to notice? Because you said that Ukraine is gradually gaining ground. That's not true. Since you were here the last time, Ukraine has lost territory. 500,000 men are dead. Ukraine has had to resort to conscription. There's reports of signing people up with disability, with mental illness, men paying money to get out of the country, hiding in their houses. We're now in a bloody war of attrition, and it's simply cruel for it to go on. Now, senior US military personnel are even getting into the pages of the Washington Post and so on, echoing the call made by General Milley last November, that there should be peace and a real peace. If you care about Ukraine, what's your attitude for a peace plan to save Ukrainian lives?
Basically, I can answer. This is a direct quote from Stoltenberg earlier this year, or whenever, at some point. He said, weapons are the way to peace.
Yeah.
That's a direct quote. So to answer Claire's question, Jens Stoltenberg's peace plan is weapons. Weapons are the way to peace. And by the way, you know, Max, to your point about the death toll, you know, being in the hundreds of thousands for Ukraine, maybe even 500,000. I think that's what you said. So Claire Daly there said that, you know, 500,000 Ukrainian men have died.
I think she means the total, including Russians, but which it would be correct based on the Pentagon's estimates. But
okay,
she could also be correct about Ukrainians alone.
Yeah, I took that to mean, I mean, I could be wrong, but I took that to mean Ukraine. And I noticed that Stoltenberg did not correct her, you know. And that reminds me of that time when, what's her name, Ursula von der Leyen, you know, like the head of the EU. Of the
Ursula von der Leyen.
She made the mistake of talking in a speech about like over 100,000 Ukrainian dead. And that got, and then they had to edit that out because she wasn't allowed to acknowledge the toll. And that was a while ago. But this reminds me of that. It's just like, you know,
I think they edited out of the tweet and out of their social media accounts because it was like, yeah, we got to keep going, keep killing more because democracy, we're going to win.
Yeah.
It's rare to see Stoltenberg put on the spot like that. But I think it's inevitable when the war is just not proceeding the way that we were told it was going to be by him, by Ann Applebaum and Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic, by Tony Blinken himself, who said that Russia is not only the second strongest army in Europe, it's now, or the second largest army in the world, it's now the second strongest army in Ukraine. So he actually said, this is just in June, right before the counteroffensive started in earnest. He said that Russia was a weaker army than Ukraine's. I mean, where's the accountability for him? Where's the press?
Yeah. Well, what they're doing now, though, is they're getting top officials, because of the leaks that have come out saying that U.S. intelligence, you know, has concluded that Ukraine won't achieve its goals in the counteroffensive, primarily the goal of severing Russia's land bridge to Crimea. What seems to be going on is now some people are getting pressured to say the right thing. So this, for example, is from the so-called Institute for the Study of War, that neocon so-called think tank.
For the Promotion of War.
So this is what they – so they're promoting now a new interview from Trent Mall, who's the director of analysis for the Pentagon's Defense Intelligence Agency. That's the Pentagon's intelligence wing. And he recently spoke to The Economist, and they say this: U.S. Defense – Intelligence Agency Director of Analysis Trent Mall stated there is a realistic possibility that Ukrainian forces will break through the entire Russian defense in southern Ukraine by the end of 2023, while a Ukrainian source suggested that upcoming Russian defensive positions are weaker than those Ukrainian forces have previously breached. So now this guy is saying there's a realistic possibility that Ukrainian forces will break through the entire Russian defense this year. That's the first I'm hearing of this, and it totally contradicts other leaks that we've gotten from U.S. intel. And it also contradicts even what his own official said not too long ago, that Ukraine did not have much of a chance. This is John Kirchhofer of the Defense Intelligence Agency.
Certainly we are at a bit of a stalemate. We do see incremental gains by Ukraine as they commit to this counteroffensive over the summer, but we haven't seen anything to really help them break through, you know, for example, to drive to the Crimea. It's interesting to me, we tend to focus on some of the munitions that the West provides to Ukraine as they fight this out. And we look at some of them as holy grails as they play out. So if you think of HIMARS, certainly that led to some sensational tactical events, and then you see the Storm Shadow missile doing the same thing, and now we're talking about dual purpose improved conventional munitions or cluster bombs. You know, none of these, unfortunately, are the holy grail that Ukraine is looking for, that I think will allow them in the near term to break through.
So that was a DIA official just a few months ago saying that Ukraine does not have a prospect of breaking through Russian lines. Now the head of analysis for his agency is saying something different. But all this reminds me of a controversy that happened in Syria now 6 years ago, or actually longer, when some whistleblowers, like dozens of people who work for the Defense Intelligence Agency, put out a complaint saying that their leaders were taking their intelligence related to ISIS and Al-Qaeda inside Syria and cooking the books, basically giving the public and the administration a false picture. And we don't know the exact content of what the actual intelligence said beyond that it was related to Al-Qaeda and ISIS. But based on what we know from what the DIA said before, we know based on what's been released, that the DIA was warning from the start that the insurgency the U.S. was supporting was dominated by Al-Qaeda. And so they came and accused their leaders of cooking the books and preventing the public from knowing about this and giving the administration a false picture. But then you had an investigation on this from the Pentagon leadership. And guess what? They concluded that CENTCOM did nothing wrong. Report: CENTCOM leaders didn't cook didn't cook ISIS intelligence. So nothing to see here. Totally fine.
You've been listening to another episode of Gray Zone Radio. This episode was the first half of a live broadcast. To hear the rest of this broadcast, visit the Gray Zone's YouTube channel, which you can find linked on the Gray Zone's website. That's thegrayzone.com. In addition to YouTube, you can follow us on Telegram, Instagram, and Twitter. Thanks for listening. I've been your co-host, Christopher Weaver.
Hi, this is Denise Akbari, a journalism student and reporter for KPFK's Cal State LA Community News Hour. I was thrilled and beyond honored to contribute my story without love or money, which is part of the Race, Class, and Gender in American Journalism Class project, Herb But Hopeful, and my story, Buried Dreams, produced for the UT Community News Class, to the show. KPFK has helped me reach a bigger audience by making my reporting accessible through a different medium. Cal State LA Community News Hour has also helped me learn how to record and produce audio stories, which are real-world experiences. This is a great opportunity. Thanks so much to KPFK's staff and volunteers for allowing me to be part of this.
KPFK, your community radio station. Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting Ethiocolor on Friday, September 29th at 8 p.m. at the UCLA Nimoy Theater. Led by Malaku Bele, Ethiocolor creates energetic performances that blend contemporary influences with the traditional instruments and the shoulder-shimmying dances of Ethiopia's Asmari culture. For more information, visit cap.ucla.edu or kpfk.org.
Hi, this is Jessica Aldridge from Eco Justice Radio. Check us out on KPFK at our new time, Fridays from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. Join us as we present environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame intended to amplify community voices, broaden the reach of grassroots-based movements, and inspire action. That's Eco Justice Radio, Fridays at 4 p.m. on KPFK Los Angeles. And remember to support the station by visiting kpfk.org to make your donation.
All of the above, 2 to 4, then Saturday night.
Okay, I know it's late, but sometimes you just get inspired to rock, right?
Yeah. I did.
All of the above radio, growing on the west coast of the Milky Way, with your host Bango, in rare form as usual, but I'll synthesize it right before your eyes.
So show your appreciation!
Yeah. Light year group.
A journey through high quality music that's always fun. Late Saturday night, 2 to 4 a.m., right after In the Cut with DJ Ben Vera.
Let's go!
This goes out. Please listen.
Now have a light! Grab a big fat cigar.
Listen.
The funk, the people, the bomb!
Anything and everything is possible when you tune in to the one and only All of the Above with Jane.
I play music of the night.
On the radio.
And the fantasies of dreamers come true.
Make this a weekly habit, and hey, call a friend and tell them to tune in to this particular station.
Past shows available at AOTARadio.com. All of the above.
It's just-